Our next guest, Tracker Dan, lifelong survivalist, tracker, legendary knife maker, Navy SEAL, friend, and above all else, brother. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Dan.
Yeah.
Welcome. This has been a long time coming.
Yes.
When we started this project of, you know, doing this podcast, kind of the main reason why we started it is as a companion piece to the training that we provide. I do a lot of survival, urban survival, showing people how to get out of hairy situations type training, both for the government and for civilians. And every now and then when I'm doing some of these classes, I get asked, like, hey, where'd you learn that weird trick? I showed some people how to make a length of rope with garbage bags.
Yeah.
And your name always comes up. And it always comes up in a lot of conversations around myself and some of my history. Before we go into our shared history, so people can know a little bit about you, Dan, what part of the world originated you, Dan, as a person? We'll talk about why you're kind of a interesting character, but like, where were you born?
Southern California, Laguna Beach, and back in the hippie days. And then I was in San Fernando Valley for till I was like 6 or 7, then up in Canada.
You moved around a lot.
Yeah.
Family related issues that got you basically traveling around like a hippie.
Yeah. Well, when I was 4, my mom remarried and my stepdad was from Vietnam, you know, military type stuff, and so we never spent more than 2 years in one place, like always moving. And
what does that do to you when you're a kid?
I mean, you get a lot of new experiences, but you don't make
friends,
lifelong friends per se.
Yeah,
I think
it's a solitude, a little bit of some loneliness.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, and we were in some really remote areas too, like up in British Columbia. Like,
what were you guys doing out there in British Columbia?
So, yeah, we went up there mainly as missionaries to this remote Indian fishing village on the coast of British Columbia, like 150 miles north of Vancouver. And the only way you can get in there for most of the year is by ocean. You know, otherwise it's snowed in on the Switchback Mountain Pass. So
you're basically there spreading the good word.
Yeah.
In the middle of like a remote wilderness.
Yeah.
Supplies, support.
It was an Indian fishing village, but, you know, they had modern boats and there's cars and stuff and there's totem poles and long house cedar houses, but there's a lot of government type dwellings and, you know,
yeah,
a lot of the Indians are having a problem with alcohol and all that kind of stuff. So,
You're out there basically living this traveling life. Your mom, tell us a little bit about your mom.
Yeah, so she was part Indian, American Indian, and was raised on a ranch, you know, so she was on horseback just out in the middle of nowhere up in Oregon growing up kind of thing. And she always wanted to connect with her Indian heritage, you know, so she learned what she could and she passed it on to me. So we'd always be collecting wild edibles and making primitive dwellings and stuff like that.
So is that what kind of started you off on this path of survival, self-reliance?
Yeah.
Like I remember at one point you and my daughter were walking somewhere and you started like pointing out, oh, you can eat that, you can't eat that, you probably stay away from that. So is that your mother? The mother is the one that kind of started you off on this path.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, she had me sewing my own moccasins when I was 4 years old, learning how to make mukluks and different things for up north there. And I, you know, shooting a bow and arrow since I was 4 years old. And my stepdad, he always had us out fishing, camping, hunting all the time. So
exposure.
Yeah.
You told me the story about your stepdad basically giving you like tests.
Yeah. He called them Willie tests. So
Willie tests.
So wilderness man test.
Okay.
So it's Willie test.
So how old are you when he's doing these Willie, like
first one I recall was 6 years old, and it's basically, you know, you can keep your boots on, but it's snowing outside, 2 feet of snow, and you got to run around the trailer, you know, in the middle of the night, knocking so he knows how many times you went around, and, you know, different things like breaking a hole in the ice and jumping in, and
so like
naked snow angels, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Now, like people listening to that, they didn't have that type of childhood, and then that type of parentage, like it would be, like holy shit. It's an intense way of growing up, basically. It's not a normal way.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of cultures throughout time have had rites of passage, where you know, so you know, boys become men, and it builds confidence and different things like that, and it takes away fear, you know, because you experience something and you realize, yeah, it sucked, but I've done it, and I can do it again, and I can do it better, you know. And
was it strict growing up? I mean, you talk about them, your family being Christian, trying to
he was really strict, definitely religiously so, and then the discipline from the military, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, it was all there.
But you know, it made me hate English and writing, because he used to be a photojournalist, and so he'd pick all my homework apart. But like, you know, and he'd never give me anything. I had to work for it with the dictionary, so I have a great vocabulary because of it, you know.
Yeah.
I know how to shoot a gun really well, you know, make every bullet count because of, you know, the strictness and discipline. So
the moving around aspect, and also just being in this culture. Like, what about you? What are your friends? Like, what are your dreams when you're growing up? Like, what are you looking at that is providing you any sort of, like, push forward? Are you reading any books? Is there any sort of inspiration going on as far as what you want to be when you grow up there?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of raised on Conan and Tarzan and that kind of thing. And, I mean, I wish the parkour stuff was out when I was younger, because I was kind of doing that stuff, but I didn't just take didn't it know. As far as I could have with what's out there now, you know.
Yeah.
But, I just always wanted to be self-sufficient, be able to provide for myself and loved ones anywhere, no matter what the situation, you know, just if you had nothing, you could use the natural resources.
Yeah, so you're basically developing a lot of skills and practicing a lot of just life skills in general that were going to come handy later on. Because I've met and trained with a lot of instructors in survival field. But it's very apparent with you that you have a lot of these skills, since you, I mean, some of these people call them primitive skills. And I think there's like a life element to them. Like when you learn them at an early age, like the way you explain that you used to make moccasins. And for people that don't know what sewing a needle, like you needle in leather and working with leather like that, that'll make you toughen up your hands at an early age.
Yeah, definitely.
You describe. Would you describe your youth as a religious kind of family and nucleus in the past, like a Christian, basically?
Yeah. I think my mom kind of converted to that when I was 11 months old or something like that. So it's all I knew growing up. And, you know, it's, yeah, it's a deep subject, but it's with any organization, whether it's religion, anything, it becomes its own kind of thing where it's like the people in it, they feel like this is the best thing going on the planet. This is going to bring the most benefit and change and you know.
True believers.
Yes. And, you know, everybody should be doing this and all that kind of stuff. And there comes a lot of self-sacrifice, you know, of the things that are in your heart to do because you're, you know, my life is dedicated towards God's will kind of thing and nothing else matters kind of thing. So, yeah, there was a lot of that. And I was a serious true believer.
What changed, Dan? What happened between you being a serious true believer and being a part of this Christian organization that was trying to, you know, prepare, make more Christians out there?
Yeah.
What caused you to step back a bit?
So, luckily, there was more serious, you know, because a lot of religion is, oh, you're okay, I'm okay, you know, it's real sappy, lovey-dovey type stuff. And there was a more serious group within, you know, that was kind of separate from the church, you know, and we ran this exotic animal farm. And
wait, don't skip that part. You had an internal group in the church that ran an exotic, wait, okay, explain this exotic animal farm.
So it was separate from the church. And
side hustle.
Yeah, but it so we basically had to kind of be self-sufficient and like beg, borrow, and steal to make things work, you know, because we're taking land that's been just denatured by commercial corn crop type stuff, and we're trying to reintroduce bison, eland, you know, the largest antelope in the world kind of thing, mouflon sheep, you know, emu, all kinds of stuff, and restore the soil, you know. And so, but the people running this, they're, you know, like one of them was ex-FBI, like retired from the FBI, and his son was prior SF. And so there was a little more grittiness to it, you know, and a lot more just brutal honesty, you know, none of that sappy stuff. And the son, the SF guy, he started really asking me questions of like, you know, what's in your heart? Like you really need to, you know, because I was just putting everything on a shelf as far as all my ninja, you know, Indian scout type things that I loved and wanted to do.
That was in the closet.
Yeah. Yeah. So for God, you know, kind of thing. And so he just got me to really be honest with myself and stop denying what was really in my heart. And
what was it, man? You just wanted to live this life of adventure. Did you feel a drive or a push to basically what's out there for me?
Yeah, like I wanted to delve more into the survival stuff, and I had been following Tom Brown's stuff loosely.
Tom Brown is...
Junior.
Tom Brown Jr., what's the name of his original book? I mean, that thing...
The Tracker.
The Tracker,
yeah.
Which is like a classic...
Yeah.
Like survival book. I think it's one of the first of its kind in contemporary...
As far as the storyline and the tracking experiences in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, how old were you when you read that book? Like, I think I was I don't know, 19 when I read that book. Like, I was older. Like, I missed it, I guess, but...
Yeah, I was 14 at the time, I believe, and, like, back in 84. And so then I, you know, because I'd been seeking that knowledge everywhere, and... he was doing Mother Earth News articles, and so I'd learn as much as I could from them. And because you just couldn't find the stuff in libraries back
then. There's no internet. There's libraries. Yeah. But realistically, there's not a lot of specialized books on survival, bushcrafting. Bushcraft is not a word yet, you know?
Yeah.
So you're basically knowledge starved. You want to learn some of this stuff. And you find it all concentrated in this weird book by this dude that is basically, you know, churning out the science aspects of just the minutiae of it.
Yeah, yeah. So with this guy getting me to, like, see what was in my heart, that led me to go take a class at the tracker school. And, you know, my mom had always, even though she was part Indian, she had said, you got to be careful of, you know, a lot of these earth-based religion kind of things, you know, where they worship creation instead of the creator. And
so she was giving you some warnings about this kind of being outside of faith.
Yeah.
The faith boundaries
that
were there.
Because it, you know, when I finally saw Lisa Remy's special on Scientology, like the church that I was in, they were doing all the same stuff, you know, not on as sophisticated a level, but same stuff. Just
basic cult.
Yeah, just driving wedges between family members and like, if you're not part of us, you're against us, all that kind of stuff, you know.
So you start, I mean, I guess when you start to emancipate yourself from this, you know, that the first step of emancipation you had from this religious cult, which most of them are in a way, I guess, your first step was going to the tracker school, I guess.
Yeah, and the reverence they had for the creator was, and the thankfulness they had for what the creator provides and all that kind of stuff was way beyond anything I learned.
What year did you go, the first time going to the tracker school, what year was this?
95.
They were a pretty big and popular school back then.
Yeah.
Like, what's the first class at the cracker school like for you? Like, what are you experiencing going there for the first time?
So it was at a farm, and so it's easier for people to get to for just the basic standard class. You know, you're not going out in the wilderness yet, kind of thing. And you are getting a download of so much information on tracking, survival, philosophy, you name it. Awareness was, you know, a big part of it. And then you're getting practical experience. So you're making a bow drill fire, carving your own parts for it, all that kind of stuff. And it was great up there for wild edibles because, you know, you get down in the pine barrens and there's not much.
We'll talk about that desert environment in a bit, but yeah. So you already have some skills to you. You know, you've basically been working rurally, woodworking as well. I mean,
I did 10 years of carpentry.
Good Christian, man. You were just, you know, all about being like the Jesus. So you were
Jesus was a carpenter.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, nowadays, that's missing in a lot of people's lives. I mean, trade skills are pretty hard to come by. So you went into that school as a student for the first time, having this life experience behind you, also being a carpenter and just being generally self-sufficient and handy because you had to be.
Yeah.
Do you find a place for you there?
Yeah. So I had tried bow drill like back when I was 12, got smoke, but you know, didn't want to try too hard because if it didn't work and I gave it my all.
For people that don't know what bow drill is, basically it's a primitive way of starting fire.
Yeah.
Right. And can you describe what a bow drill is?
Yeah. So it'll have like a 9-inch spindle, a handhold, a fireboard with some tinder under the fireboard. And then you've got a bow with a string and the string wraps around the spindle.
Yeah.
And you provide pressure. And
you were the first person to show me how to start a fire like that. But like, again, I also saw it. Oh, I've seen some videos, you know, in a book.
Yeah.
But I've tried and it's like the wood was all wrong. The cord was all loose. It was just too pointy on the bottom.
Yeah.
The bowl didn't have an air wedge.
Yeah.
And you basically went through like, hey, this is how you do it, and these are all the stupid ways of doing it, and these are the efficient ways.
Yeah.
Which is like a mind-blowing thing. I remember getting smoke the first time, and it's like, it's magical.
Yeah.
It's magic. It's a magical experience being able to just create fire and have that ability to carry fire with you as far as a knowledge base.
Mm-hmm.
But again, people need to realize this is before the internet, and there's books, and there's vague notions of it. But now you're in a place where this is a specialty that they're doing there, like fire creation, survival, gathering.
And one of the biggest things I learned from Tom was you've got to make as many mistakes as you can in training so you don't make them when your life's on the line or someone else's is. So, because like when I was 12, I was getting smoke with the bow drill, but I didn't want to try too hard because then I would feel like a failure if it didn't work, you know, that kind of thing. And so we tend to hold ourselves back by not wanting to fail. And he just cut me loose on just make as many fuck-ups as you can, you know. So that really set me free. And
as an instructor, like, how is he? Like, is he strict? Is he hands-on? Is he standoffish? Like, what was your experience with him?
So his role at the school when I was going through was more inspiration. So amazing storyteller. Like, he can pull heartstrings like you wouldn't believe, and just the visualness of his story is just amazing. But he wasn't doing a lot of the teaching. He had instructors for that. And part of that was he didn't want people to feel like, oh, wow, Tom can do it, but I could never do that. You know, like,
yeah.
So that was part of it. And, you know, people start to doubt, you know, whether he can do that stuff. But every once in a while, you see him play, and it's like, wow, he has done that thousands upon thousands of times, you know. But he didn't want it to be a thing where everybody just worships and wants to watch and talk about it kind of thing.
So he was basically working through his cadre, his students. Like,
hey, yeah.
These
making it easier for people to connect with someone who's more like them, you know, it's not on a pedestal.
So you go there first as a student, and then you're like, what's your reaction as the first experience there? Like, you're learning how to make fire. You're learning a lot about detailed methodologies of things that you've only kind of like had a vague notion of.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean, it was like I was taking notes, tape recording, like I was gathering as much information as I could.
You walk out of that experience, what's in your head?
Just go practice, you know. So, like, as soon as I got home, made a debris hut, slept in it overnight, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, even being an adult, it's like that first time of, you know, not being sealed into a tent or anything like that.
You made this.
There's that, but there's just like, you know, there's all the sounds and, you know, you don't have you're not sealed off, you know, kind of thing.
There's a moment, like, I've done some of this stuff with you.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where it's like letting go of one shore and then grabbing onto the other, I guess, when you're swimming between spaces.
Yeah.
It's realizing that if you didn't do your job correctly in this leaf den that you're created for yourself, the coming night and the temperature and the ground itself is going to leach every single bit of warmth out of your body.
Yeah.
And it's, you can't blame the manufacturer of the sleeping bag. You can't, you can't depend on that. You have to make everything yourself. And if you fucked up, it's not only on you. I mean, it's, you're going to suffer for it. You know?
Yeah.
So is that what you like?
Well, I mean, I was trying all this stuff growing up. Like, I'd get an old Marine wool sleeping bag. So doesn't provide much warmth like a modern one, and I'd be putting grass underneath me, but like I don't understand the concept of, you need it to be like
a lot,
a foot to a foot and a half thick, and then you compress it down, and then you're going to be
warm, or you're not going to be, your heat's not going to be leached out of you.
Yeah.
So you basically, you got this experience. You're trying to work on it more. What leads you to then go back and say, hey, how do I become one of you guys?
I don't know if I had that thought per se, but I wanted to get back there as soon as I could.
You want to learn more?
Yeah. So you have to take that beginning class, and then you've got to take the next two that are in a row before you can kind of branch off into either Apache Scout type classes or the philosophy.
I wanted to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of our Patreon members for their generous support. It's the only way we can bring some of these amazing people behind the microphone and have some of these amazing Midnight of the Soul conversations for you guys. If you're not already a part of the Patreon community, please consider joining us. We have our giant online training catalog for you guys to have access to, as well as some exclusive Sneak Reaper Industries merch drops for you guys at the Dead Drop tier. I would also like to thank the company Sneak Reaper Industries, one of our main supporters and a company that provides some of the most amazing urban wear, survival specific, and cutlery out there. Your support not only makes this show possible, but also supports some of the charities that we run, including the Fighter's Kitchen out of Puerto Escondido, where we're supporting some up-and-coming fighters under the tutelage of Eddie Farrell. Thank you for your support, and again, please consider joining us on the Patreon. And now back to the show.
The Apache Scout class that they had, or I mean, the scouting in this kind of survival school, it's at the end of the spectrum as far as like the basic training that they provide there. It's like an advanced class.
It is. You have to go through the first three classes on basic survival and awareness. So, and of course, there's stuff mixed in from, you know, philosophy, Native American philosophy, and scout skill type stuff.
But, so for people I was curious about it, you know?
Yeah.
When you get to the scouting class, what is being taught at this level?
It's basically invisible survival.
So it's, you can't walk around with your big red backpack and your Columbia gear.
Well, there is an aspect to it where you are wearing like a red headband because you're so good at using dead space that you don't need camouflage per se.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of camouflage training.
Basically, you're arriving there with is basically making some of your own tools an aspect of this.
Yeah, you're working with a lance and you're making scout pits, so invisible shelters. So it's down in the earth,
like spider holes.
It's more like a coffin, with an entrance over the chest area, and. You sleep in one of those. I mean, it's like total sensory deprivation. It's amazing.
It's like a burial.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you learning there, though? Is it invisible survival? Do you say like basically surviving in a place and not being seen?
Not
being spotted?
So it's moving in a way and using camouflage where, you're just not going to be seen. And anytime you're taking any materials from the landscape, you're doing it in a way where somebody's not going to notice.
So I had an experience with you, and we'll talk about our shared history, but you showed me things around scent removal. Is this where some of that came from, this exposure?
Yeah.
You showed me that all raw diets will help with some of the BO. Carbon and being able to chew carbon to, it's good for your teeth, and also it'll eliminate some of the aspects of smell.
So the raw diet thing, I can't remember what I was saying back then, but...
Something along the lines of like how to eliminate or dampen your BO and smell.
I imagine depending on what you're eating, you might create a lot of flatulence.
So yeah, depending on
that, what you... can be counterproductive, but...
Yeah. But like basically the aspects of not being able to be smelled, seen, or heard.
So using the ash and the charcoal, like a lot of Indians would do a sweat and a fast before hunting.
Yeah, sweat. So.
So you're getting all that stuff out, and then using the charcoal and the ash from the fire covers a lot of stuff, and chewing, you know, plants from the area can cover your breath, or chewing on the charcoal kind of thing.
Yeah.
People do not chew on briquettes. They got a lot of chemicals in them.
Not
flammable stuff.
So. Yeah, not those. I remember you were showing me some of these things, and they seem extreme to people. Like, why would you want to learn all this shit? Because people will, like, you can just, I don't know, they have this sense of normalcy of what is, what could be possible, but it's not outside the confines of where they grew up or where they live, and they can't envision themselves in this place where you don't have anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's another world, and you know, our world is all about selling you something, so everything's bright, flashy, look at me, you know, buy me, you know, that kind of thing. And you get in nature, everything's trying to hide, so your awareness has to like adjust. Yes. And you know, wide angle vision, you know, to be able to spot any kind of movement, whereas in our society it's everything's tunneled in and look at this, look at that, come on.
Everything's in a square box, basically. Yeah. You're driving, it's a rectangle. Cell phone.
Yeah.
Down the street, everything's basically in a box.
Yeah.
So when you go out into I'm going to keep describing moments of learning that I've had from you where you had me walk barefoot as I was learning a little bit about tracking. And when you're barefoot, it makes you slow down and makes you really purposeful as far as where you're going to put your foot, basically.
Yeah.
And that leads to like an aspect of awareness, because now you're not only having one plane of observation, you're also looking down at the ground and, you know, a little bit up. So like there's levels to it.
Yeah. And you know, just getting that natural massage on your feet, like I think a lot of people's knees go bad because they're not getting the toxins out from not getting massage. And also, you know, you have knee, hip, low back issues from people landing on their heels because they got all this padding and they think that protects them, but it doesn't. And so it causes them to walk in a way that we're not designed to.
Yeah. I mean, I remember you, she's learning this from you, like, let me just do more barefoot stuff. And it's been, I mean, I felt the effects of it from my knees all the way up to my back. It's just a different way of moving. You're going through this scout class. You're learning how to be invisible. You're learning to be more aware of what's around you. It's like sounds, birds, things scurrying away and flying away. Are you learning how to hunt? Are you learning how to, you know, what part does making points and weaponry fall into this? Like
in the Apache Scout stuff?
Yeah.
It was more for, you know, doing missions and stuff like that. So, you know, we learned a lot of self-defense stuff or offense.
Which is kind of out, it's out of the box. Because if you go to a lot of modern survival schools of this kind, I mean, they don't intermingle that much.
Yeah.
You survive, leave the place untouched, you know, be conscientious of the environment. But stabbing somebody in the neck is not in the curriculum usually.
Yeah. And, you know, Tom was always saying that the scout is the last one to pick up the lance because he's using his scout skills to know when danger's coming and you avoid it. Like you keep the tribe away from danger. You don't like, oh, we're going to square off, you know. But when the time comes to pick up the lance and there's no other choice, like you know how to use it kind of thing. So, so that was the main thing with that. And, you know, the priorities of survival are shelter, fire, water, food, and fire only comes for water because you got to be able to purify your water kind of thing. So when I teach, I actually teach self-defense is the first thing because, you know.
You're the first instructor that I think I've heard say like, hey, like these are all your survival priorities? Yeah.
Yeah.
What about this one, you know, which is security?
Yeah, because, you know, without proper shelter, you can die within 3 hours. You know, without water, some people say 3 days. I know it can go a lot longer. Yada, yada. 3 months without food. So, but you run into the wrong two-legged animal or even four-legged animal, you know, 3 seconds, you can be gone. Yeah. So,
The aspect of that's kind of off-putting to a lot of people that want to connect to nature, you know?
Yeah, and I was going to have, like, more of my tactical survival and more of my tree-hugging survival, but then I realized I don't want to train people that are not willing to save the ones they love with violence if they need to. Like, because there are some people that will not do violence no matter what.
They'll just cut it off. They're like, I'm just going to blind myself to the realities. And you just mentioned that two-legged animal.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Just bad people.
I mean, that's like realistically, if you, like you've been in this field for years. You put a priority on our main predator, which is humans.
Yeah.
You go from being a student of the tracker school to now being a full-time instructor.
Well, so after my third class,
you
know, and the skill they saw that I had, because I could work wood just from my carpentry experience, and I'd tried some of this stuff growing up. Like, I'd made a bow when I was, you know, probably around the same age, 12 or even younger. So they asked me to become a caretaker of the primitive camp back in the Pine Barrens. And
for people that don't know, Pine Barrens are in Jersey.
Yeah.
It's
there's 2.1 million acres of no man's land. That's just all pitch pine, scrub oak, sand, and clay.
There's like
Cedar swamps.
Cedar swamps.
Beautiful cedar swamps.
But realistically, as far as resources for survival, it's pretty barren.
Yeah.
It's a barren place.
Yeah. Very.
I mean, it's called the Pine Barrens.
Yeah.
So they basically task you with being the caretaker, and also basically you're going to be learning how to instruct there, of course.
Yeah. Help out with classes. And then in between classes, just working on skill and tracking and trying not to go stir crazy out there. Cause like,
What are you doing out there? I mean, it's a lot of time. I imagine there's a lot of time alone.
Yeah.
They
would go through caretakers fast because a lot of people just couldn't handle the solitude.
Yeah.
And the two things I missed the most was like a hot shower and music.
You know, was dead quiet out there.
Yeah.
Was it a rule that it would have to be dead quiet, or did you just take anything there to distract you?
This was back 95, and like so. Not even a radio. So you didn't have like solar panel you could bring out, you know, all that kind of stuff. And there was no electricity out there, and no running water.
Books and magazines. That's about it.
Yeah, plenty of books.
You're going through winters out there and stuff like that?
Yeah. So I did it for a year and a half. And it's also very, like, you can't ever see the horizon there. So I got in the habit of, and, like, after my third class, I, like, gave away my tents, my sleeping bags, because I can make a shelter anywhere kind of thing. And so I showed up with a backpack full of wool clothing. And I quickly learned that, because I showed up in the wintertime, so like making a debris hut, you know, because everything's covered in foot and a half of snow. You can do it, but it was like, so I ended up, you know, taking over another shelter and kind of just covering myself with my wool sweaters and pants. And so I was the last one in bed and the first one up because I didn't have a comfy sleeping bag. So I would climbed the tallest pine tree I could find. I was probably like easily 60 feet up there. And I would get up to where I could see over the top branches and I could watch the sunset. Yeah. And then I was the first one up because there was no warm sleeping bag to keep me comfy. And so I would see every sunrise. And I did this for like 4 months. And it was amazing, you know, just as far as getting the most out of my day, you know, seeing how the sun changed, you know, on the horizon, like throughout the year kind of thing. And getting up above all the trees, I think, really helped because I could...
You could orientate.
I mean, I could see hills and different things like that.
I imagine there's like a claustrophobia aspect to just being...
I would think so, yeah. Yeah.
Students are coming in and you start teaching there.
Yeah.
Who are these people? Like, who's showing up to learn?
So it is just a crazy cross-section. Like you,
and this is around the time when it's really getting really popular.
I don't know the graph scale of when it was popular and when it got more and stuff like that, but you know it's right before Y2K, so that might be playing into it a little bit. But you've got doctors, deadheads, you know, like drum circle kind of thing. Especially when Jerry Garcia died, so many of them showed up.
why there? It was just like
a
thing.
Yeah. And, but you've got preppers, you've got lawyers, like.
Are you seeing people show up with a shit ton of gear and then some people not showing up with anything or like what's.
Yeah. Yeah. You get, you know, you definitely get an interesting cross section. There was a lot of people from Germany because there's a cult following over there of American or Indian philosophy type stuff. And so. Yeah, I mean, it was, and a lot of Japanese, too. And, it was interesting.
Like later on, knives become a big part of your life. Like, what are you carrying as far as a knife there? Like, what are you, it's, imagine it's, like, a very important tool.
Yeah.
So what's, like, your basic tool set for that environment? You mentioned wool clothing, which is great. Shout out to Lester River Bushcraft.
Yeah, yeah.
You make some of the best wool jackets on the planet. The best ones on the planet. Oh.
Love them.
Yeah. I remember like, wool, icky. And I was like, this is the warmest stuff in the world. So you mentioned wool clothing.
Yeah.
What else is like an essential item out there for you?
Like you said, blade. And luckily, like when I was 14, I found that Razor's Edge Book of Sharpening, which just, because since I was 6 years old, I was trying to sharpen my knives and spend hours and you don't know what you're doing and you don't know how to know if you've got it where you need it. You know, it's not shaving kind of thing. But like after that book, like I was shaving my head with big old Bowie knife, you know, and then taking that into carpentry and just sharpening all my tools. Like everybody wanted to borrow my tools because they were sharp and they worked, you know, and they come back dull because people don't know how to treat an edge that they've spent hours making perfect.
So,
you know?
So is this like this experience that you're having at that school, is it giving you a lot of the fundamentals, I guess, for later on when you kind of like go full time into knife making?
I would say like I always, even before the tracker school, I always leaned towards thin, light, concealable stuff.
Which is odd because the tracker school and specifically Tom Brown is known for a big ass hatchet knife.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Tom Brown tracker knife.
Yeah.
You know? Like I knew about him first and then I learned about you and just seeing the juxtapose of the different knife philosophies as far as like which would you carry? It's like I don't want to carry that spatula, I want to carry that small knife.
You know? Yeah.
You're there at the tracker school. You're trying to basically learn as much as you can, and also the experience you're getting is fucking gold.
Yeah.
You're teaching a lot of people. Like, what's the mindset of people showing up there? What are they preparing for? Is it just people that want to have fun the weekend, or is it some people that actually have this?
I think it's And we had such a crazy cross-section because of all of Tom's books, I think, you know, because so much of them are very spiritual, you know, then some are just all survival. And so you've got people there for all different reasons. And
did you get a lot of people showing up with, like, crystals hanging up from their, like, necks?
Yeah, way too many. We called them, what was it, white buffaloes or something. Yeah, it was.
Which is
was,
great. Yeah. If people are that kind of spiritual nature, we need more of you in the world. But, you know, chill out.
So the Christian religion I was in was very spiritual based and that kind of thing. Like, it's almost people sometimes gravitate towards that spiritual aspect because they think, oh, it's more important than the physical. So they let their bodies go to shit. And it's like, oh, God will save me when I need it kind of thing. Yeah. Or, you know, and at the tracker school, there was people who were like, oh, you know, I don't need to practice those physical skills because the spirit will provide for me, like, you know, the crow bring food to Elijah or whatever, you know, like when I need it kind of thing. And I was just like, I was so fed up with that from being raised in it. And then I see it there. I'm just like, I just delved into the physical skills. And I don't believe you can separate physical and spiritual.
On my end, like, God helps those that help themselves, you know?
Yeah.
You know, respect the gods and the Buddhas, but, you know, don't count on their help, is like Musashi would say.
Yeah.
I think that's been kind of my philosophy. Like, I get the spiritual aspect of people wanting that in their lives and the connection, you know?
Yeah.
And the belief that there's something bigger than us.
Yeah.
But dude, bring a canteen, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you'd probably remember it better than I, but like, and it's not really the best segue, but like Joe Rogan says, we're all just a bunch of superstitious monkeys traveling through space on a big rock, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, our superstitious nature causes us to, you know, believe in the craziest stuff sometimes, you know, like, or cling to something or try and make sense of everything by, okay, this is how we make sense of this, you know, whether it's by conspiracy theories or through religion, you know, like, and it's like, you know, we're just not going to know until the time comes, I mean, you know, really.
I mean, for me, the magical aspect or like where I experience the divine, I guess, in this world is just, you know, transmutation, being able to make something out of nothing. I mean, I remember you showed me how to make primitive cordage.
Yeah.
You had me out there fucking processing grass and shit. And I was like, well, what am I going to do with this cord? And you just pointed to a kettlebell and you say, you have to hang the kettlebell from the bench. And it seemed like such an easy task, but like, you have to make the cord out of grass to hang that from that bench. And after my hands went atrophied, I finally tied that thing up. I think that was way more meaningful and spiritual than anything I've ever experienced in a church for me.
Mm.
I mean, that connected me more to the grass.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is good grass. This is bad grass.
Yeah.
Oh, look, grass has fibers inside of it. Oh, it has moisture. You need to process this. If you don't twist it the right way.
Well,
and if you don't braid it.
Yeah.
Like, all these aspects are like connecting you.
Yeah. And I like Thich Nhat Hanh's stuff on, like, he's talking about, like, when you're eating something, like, you are picturing everything that went into what you have before you, like the people that brought it to you or cooked it for you, but just all the sun and the rain and the wind and everything that helped create that, like, go on that journey in your mind to just really connect with it and understand the interconnectedness of everything, you know what I mean? It's definitely, I think it's a way to live more stress-free, you know, and more thankful.